Before we get to today's show, a special request to any of you who are American expats living overseas. We want to hear from you about what it's like to vote by mail from abroad. As the primaries and November 3rd draw near, what questions or worries do you have about getting your vote in the mail and getting it counted back in your home state? Email a voice memo to myworld@theworld.org. Tell us your name, your location, and we might contact you for a story. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. And thank you. Now here's today's show.
Heads up, fans of the world. We're putting a little something extra in your feed. Things That Go Boom, a bonus podcast to loyal listeners of The World from PRX. Things That Go Boom. Let's roll.
Recently, my husband and my stepson and my four-year-old and I all piled into a canoe.
Didn't Mommy?
At night.
Don't get me wet.
Our four-year-old is named Arlo, and it was an extra late night, but we wanted to do some stargazing with him.
Okay!
Actually, I've been wanting to learn more about celestial navigation for a while now. It's romantic, right?
I can see the moon.
It's the same technique that Shackleton used to go to Antarctica. It was referenced in Homer's Odyssey.
But those are pirates.
You think those people on that boat over there are pirates?
Yeah.
Should we be worried?
They shoot like canoes, yeah.
We're in a canoe.
If you were sailing out on the ocean and you were a pirate and you needed to get home, what would you do?
I would try to find the North Star.
There's one way that you can find the North Star if you find the Big Dipper.
All of the stars are North Stars?
No. There's just one North Star.
For almost a decade, the Naval Academy actually stopped teaching celestial navigation entirely. Who needs to worry about stars and sextants when you have GPS, right?
Whoa, you're going to get me down the sea.
Then in 2015, something changed. The Naval Academy put celestial navigation back on the curriculum. So, what was it that changed?
Hey, there's a pirate! That's a pirate! That's a pirate! I think we should go back to shore.
Okay.
Okay. Paddle back to shore, Betty.
I'm Lacey Healy, and this is Things That Go Boom, your friendly neighborhood national security podcast. This episode, the perils of high tech. The Navy brought back celestial navigation in part because, well, you can't hack a sextant. And personally, I love to think about this time in our collective history. The time when we all just thought, oh, sure, the GPS will always work. Because now it just seems so obvious. And celestial navigation is just the tip of the iceberg. So this episode, we wanted to explore some of the other ways that our race toward more and more high-tech systems, both at the Pentagon and right in our own homes, could be making us vulnerable in ways we never anticipated. Hey there. A quick favor. Things That Go Boom is conducting an audience survey, and we'd be so grateful if you could take just a few minutes and fill it out. If you're in, please visit survey.prx.org/boom to take the survey today. That's survey.prx.org/boom. Thanks. Yeah, I'll tell you though, mine can really sniff that out. He's like, this is a little green. Is there something in here?
I'm telling you, a little bit of chocolate or peanut butter, you can bury almost anything in there.
This is Peter Singer, a national security strategist at the think tank New America. Also, a parent.
You can put kale in and the like, and I mean, they won't notice it.
Oh, that's a good point.
And we were talking about sneaking healthy foods into our kids' diets. It's an analogy Peter uses to explain why, as an expert in 21st century warfare, he's taken to writing novels, techno thrillers, to be exact.
It's a lot like sneaking fruit and veggies into a smoothie. You know, so you get the enjoyment, you get the good taste, but you also get the good value of it.
See, Peter has some sobering messages for the defense community, but
no one ever said, man, I just read the best PowerPoint. The next time you're on vacation, you ought to read it too. But they will definitely do that with a good novel.
Peter's co-author is August Cole.
I like to say I'm an optimist who stares into the abyss.
He's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a former Wall Street Journal reporter.
So I haven't wholly thrown up my hands and, you know, gone to live in a wooded cabin in the hills. But at the same time, I don't see the kind of leadership today. I don't see the kind of investment in basics that could allow me to sleep a little easier at night.
They've written two futuristic novels together that dig into the ways that technology is changing our lives, but also making us more vulnerable to hackers, to manipulation, to terrorists, and in one of the novels, to invasion. And they're not kidding about the chocolate and the peanut butter. Those novels have gained them invites to briefings everywhere from the White House and the Pentagon to Capitol Hill, opening doors that might not have been open if they'd just stuck to writing reports. The first novel is called Ghost Fleet.
What we essentially did in Ghost Fleet is take every U.S. military leader's nightmare scenario and play it out. How would you deal with all your worst fears coming true? What we depict of the future of war is that the opening battles of, say, a World War III might be completely silent.
The book gives us an image of World War III that doesn't start on a physical battlefield.
It starts in space, where two astronauts, who are a cosmonaut and a U.S. astronaut who ostensibly are friends, have this really critical moment in which the American realizes that something has changed.
Imagine being stuck outside the International Space Station with only a tether to keep you from hurtling toward Jupiter. That's where we first meet this astronaut. The voice recognition system he's counted on to let him in is on the fritz again, and the emergency override isn't responding. Worst of all, his radio's down, so he can't communicate with his colleagues inside. After a few moments of struggling with the hatch, the radio comes back to life. And finally, he hears his friend, the cosmonaut, on the other side. But his friend suddenly isn't so friendly. When he asks to be let inside, the cosmonaut says, "I cannot. It is no longer my decision."
And from that point on, you have a cascading of systems impact that fundamentally changes the American way of war.
As satellite networks are shut down or even shot down, computer networks are hacked.
Cheap Chinese-made computer chips that are embedded in U.S. weapons and aircraft are infected with malware. Meanwhile,
the sort of assault that might have been expected to be carried out by enemy fighter bombers is conducted to devastating effect by small armed quadcopters.
By now, GPS is completely unreliable. Attackers are using a technique called spoofing to interfere with the signal and even send inaccurate coordinates.
And what's really effective about the kind of spoofing and jamming, it's not just that the signal isn't there, is that it's correct for 5 seconds. It's maybe 5 miles off for 10 seconds. It's 100 miles off for a minute. And it might go back to being accurate so that you simply cannot trust the system. And that has a knock-on effect for your entire approach to all the technology that you're working with.
Eventually, the U.S. Pacific Fleet is almost completely destroyed. China captures Hawaii, and as the U.S. fights back, it ends up relying on a lot of imaginative, low-tech solutions, like pre-digital ships. At one point, a U.S. guerrilla fighter hides from Chinese drones under a wool blanket. It's a tactic the Taliban used in real life to elude American drone searches. And all of this low-tech is a little bit of a running theme for Peter and August, who wonder if the military might need to check its current impulse to make everything as high-tech as it can possibly be. Which brings us to a theory called the revolution in military affairs. Military history is full of so-called revolutions in tech. Take the introduction of the longbow or the machine gun, for example. The idea of this latest revolution sprung up in the 90s after the first Gulf War because of the U.S. military's speed and precision, which led to a low casualty rate. It was around that time that folks started suggesting that a whole new round of major change was in process, and we might be on the verge of a seismic shift in the way wars are fought. But Peter and August wonder if we might have taken that theory a little too far and not taken enough notice, for example, that all that fancy Gulf War tech also hampered the U.S.'s ability to respond to guerrilla tactics.
What you want is, the parallels sometimes made is a escalator. You want something that's better than the regular stairs. It's new technology and it's an improvement and it's better and everything. But if it fails, it just takes you back to where you were before.
You could argue we've been spending a lot of money on elevators instead. The kind where if it fails, you're stuck inside. The F-35 is a perfect example, and one that gets mentioned a lot. It's supposed to be the most advanced multi-role fighter jet in the world. And it's the Defense Department's most expensive weapons program ever.
When advanced engineering matters most. When air superiority requires superior technology. When precision means you're ready for all possibilities. The F-35 is a step ahead.
But the plane has been plagued by problems from the start and suffered more than a dozen severe technical deficiencies during operational testing. Everything from spikes in cabin pressure to unpredictability and even structural damage at supersonic speeds. My personal favorite factoid about the F-35 is that its full name is the F-35 Lightning II. And right now, it still can't fly in thunderstorms.
So, you know, an aircraft, you know, like the F-35 is an incredible marvel. And the software, you know, that powers that plane, the computing capability is unprecedented.
Because the plane is so supremely complicated, there's a lot of precision work involved, which makes it hard to scale up production.
You know, you don't actually crank these out like Ford F-150s, you know, in Michigan.
The plane's stealth technology, for example, which makes detection by radar or sonar so difficult, it's practically invisible. Stealth isn't quite what it was when the B-2 first came about in the 80s. That's the bomber that kind of looks like a manta ray. These days, stealth is effectively outdated.
Because of wideband radars, because of what we're also learning about is the fragility of those stealthy paint coatings.
Get a little scratch in the paint and your stealth suddenly isn't so stealthy.
Now, the qualities of an aircraft to keep it stealthy 100% of the time for every single flight, it's not only expensive, it's impractical. So if you can tell me that an F-35 or an F-22 that's deployed in, let's say, a Japanese airfield or somewhere in the East or South China Sea that has been shot at, has been hit, has been flown through smoke clouds, been peppered with debris, sand, salt water, it is not going to have that stealth that perhaps the whole concept of operations is built around.
And all of this vulnerability is one reason why some experts argued against the F-35 early on, saying if we were smart, we'd just outfit existing F-15s, 16s, and 18s with most of the same capabilities for a lot less money.
I'll throw another one out there that we've seen graphically happen with the fire recently at the Bonhomme Richard.
The USS Bonhomme Richard is a billion-dollar amphibious assault ship that was undergoing maintenance and upgrades in San Diego when a fire broke out.
Temperatures at some point in excess of 1,000 degrees.
At least 40 sailors and 23 civilians suffered minor injuries.
It took 4 days and hundreds of firefighters laboring round the clock to put out the fire aboard the Bonhomme Richard.
And as you and I are speaking, the repair time is, I've seen estimates of over 3 years. That ripple effect of just this one ship being out of service is literally hitting plans for certain scenarios in the Pacific because we don't have enough ships and we don't have the ability to repair and replace them.
But it hasn't always been that way. During World War II, the U.S. built 150 aircraft carriers.
So every time we lost an aircraft carrier, not only did we have multiple ones in the pipeline to replace it, and then we had, 15 more. And so we don't have that ability right now. So let's play that out. Okay, we saw how an accident just knocked back U.S. defense plans. What if there was an actual battle? You have a lot of assumptions that are baked in that might not survive that really, really bad day. And that really, really one bad day will have a hangover effect of, literally years. And that, of course...
Speaking of that really bad day... The year Ghost Fleet came out was also the same year the Navy put celestial navigation back into its curriculum. We'll let you decide if that was a coincidence. When we come back, we'll bring Peter and August's obsession with tech down to the ground level and talk about how the programs we use in our everyday lives could be setting us up for a dystopian future. If there's one thing that this year has proven, it's that not all of our security vulnerabilities involve elegant defense systems. Just look at the ways we all personally make ourselves vulnerable to eavesdropping in our everyday lives. Every time we log on, we volunteer information about our musical preferences, our favorite coffee shop, who we hang out with. And we think, well, whatever. I don't care who's watching. It's not like I have anything to hide. We forget that all that data can be weaponized.
The average millennial will take and share 26,000 selfies.
That's Peter again.
But oh, by the way, it's not just millennials. The current U.S. president joined social media at the age of 61. That meant he entered the White House with over 40,000 bits of data about everything from what he was doing, what he was thinking, you name it.
For an adversary who's always thinking and always mindful about how do I get more information, more edge, more advantage, there's almost a limitless amount of possibilities.
And that's Peter's writing partner, August Cole, who, by the way, is also a cyclist and a rower, which means we might have one big data vulnerability in common. I don't know if either of you runs, but I run, and I'm tempted to ask you both if I should be using Strava. Strava is an exercise app athletes use to record and show their workouts, and then their friends can give them kudos. It's silly, but a little virtual motivation and accountability can be a big boost on the days you'd rather stay in bed.
I use exercise apps actually in a presentation I do for U.S. military about the benefits and costs of this mass amount of data sharing.
In 2017, Strava launched a fancy new heat map to show its users the many locations, quote, where we play.
And, you know, it had the little expected dots of light and, you know, the Bay Area and the like. And then there was this little tiny dot of light in East Africa. And they go, that's strange. You know, we didn't know we had customers in East Africa. And so they zoom down and the image, it's two perfect outlines. One is of a what was up to that point classified U.S. Special Operations Command base. And just to the south of it, a much smaller outline, which was a CIA black site. And what was happening is the guard force were basically doing their morning jogs, uploading it. It didn't just reveal the bases. It's like spy satellite quality targeting data.
Spy satellite quality targeting data on an exercise app.
Wasn't just that. There's another funny example where you were able to detect the location of an aircraft carrier at sea, because people were doing their jogs around the perimeter of the aircraft, and it had this, you know, distinct outline.
That's fantastic.
I wrestle with this too, you know, the usage of Strava and whether how much of it should be private or public. So I have a really nice Garmin Fenix that I wear for biking and ocean rowing, surfing, whatever.
I just got one of those for my birthday, by the way. They're fantastic.
You guys are giving away everything on how to hack and track you.
I've stopped.
Do you want to give your password too?
No, I'll wear it when I work out, but I've gone back to wearing just an analog watch.
As we were working on this episode, Garmin went down for 4 days because of a ransomware attack. But it's not just your watch that can get you in trouble.
There was another example from the military side of a ship was on exercises. It was a war game, and its location was unveiled by the delivery of a turkey to it to try and give the sailors a good Thanksgiving dinner. If you track the turkey, it revealed where the warship was.
It's cute, but the ability to track a person's every move and assemble a behavioral profile could also be dangerous, even deadly, in the wrong hands. In Peter and August's most recent book, Burn-In, an FBI agent named Lara Keegan partners with a robot that uses vast amounts of data, probably from exercise apps, to analyze the world around it. Together, they go after a techno-terrorist who's holding an entire city hostage.
Not to plot spoil, but in our story, essentially, one bad guy using cyber means is able to recreate versions of the 10 biblical plagues hitting Washington, D.C.
Classic thriller stuff, right?
Except the scary part is we've got the end notes to show it's not just us dreaming them up.
Peter says some of their warnings have already played out since the book was published in May.
For example, a couple of weeks after the book came out, there was a cyber attack that hit Israel's water systems that, you know, unlike old school cybersecurity where, you know, you steal information, in this case, the attackers were trying to change the chlorine level. So they were using cyber means to poison the water.
But that would never happen here, right?
If you think the small town and mostly small business run water treatment facilities in the U.S. have better cybersecurity than the Israeli government, bad news for you.
And other elements of the book, well, those we see playing out every day. Like the way AI has a dirty little tendency to fall victim to algorithmic bias. I asked August to read an excerpt from Burn-In where Agent Lara Keegan goes on a ride along with her robot partner, Tams, who's just drawn her attention to a person of interest.
So you've got an old guy with a record drinking in public. What is the reason to make him a person of interest now? Leonard has a 66% chance of being arrested during the next 30 days, Tams said. Arrested for what crime? That is not identified in the model, said Tams. So what are the key causal factors then? Mr. Leonard's past criminal record and his current public consumption of alcohol create a risk matrix of significant accuracy. That's a risk, nothing more, said Keegan. You don't know what goes on in a person's head. We change day to day, minute to minute, second to second. Maybe that next sip, Keegan pulled up a close-in view of the man drinking on the bench. Gives him that clarity, some insight. Maybe he finds God and, fortified with liquid courage, hangs out with the church choir from here on out. Tam's head spun to keep tracking Leonard as they pulled away. He does not show any association with the church or religious institution.
Most data collection and aggregation happens passively, without your consent. And once it's collected, it pretty much lives forever. Take TikTok, which President Trump has said he's going to ban unless it's bought by a U.S. company.
Being owned by Beijing-based startup ByteDance, it's been repeatedly criticized by U.S. lawmakers as
we believe that U.S. citizens' data that they have on their phones or in their system or in their healthcare records, we want to make sure that the Chinese Communist Party doesn't have a way to easily access that.
TikTok tracks the websites you're browsing and how you type, takes a look at your photos, videos, and contact information, tracks your IP address and GPS coordinates, and collects information from the messages you send on the app. All this information we put out there, it can be used to convince you to buy that pair of sunglasses you clicked on last Tuesday. Or it can be used to profile your race or political preference, even detain you for a crime you haven't committed based on the likelihood that you might commit that crime in the future. And before you go writing that off as dystopian malarkey, don't. Because a growing number of American police departments and courtrooms already use some form of predictive technology to guide their day-to-day operations. For example, to set bail.
There's no technology area that is more important to the future of our economy, our politics, our security, even our family lives, than AI and automation. AI, it's already in the hands of, you know, everything from governments to corporations to, you know, there's little elements of it playing out in your kids' apps. And yet there's also no other area that's more poorly understood.
And while we're all passively handing out our data and allowing the system to continue largely unchecked, Peter says if you step back, you can begin to see the contours of a growing data cold war between the U.S. and China. Right now, we have two competing systems.
So the Chinese model is state-led, highly centralized, and enforced data sharing. So basically, the government sees all the data that's collected as a means of, they would describe it as public security, but it's basically about social control. And they've chosen their corporate champions.
And so the result is you get what's called the social credit system, which gathers all kinds of data on Chinese citizens.
Not just what you say or do online, but, you know, whether you play video games, buy diapers, what do you think about the food at a hospital? All that data is collected, brought together, and then we use it to score and shape your behavior. That's the China model.
And then there's the U.S. model.
At the other end, we've got the sort of U.S., I won't say model, but basically you still have the same kind of level of data collection going on, but it's happening by different elements. So, you know, Facebook's gathering on you, Google's gathering on you, the police are gathering on you.
It also means that regulations are different depending on where you go.
So face recognition is a good example of that, where there are certain cities where their police forces are doing face recognition. There's other ones where they're not. But even in those cities, there's a difference between when you go into the train station versus when you go into a private business. And so there's this kind of cacophony. And those are the two different visions. And we'll see which one wins out, in quotation marks, you know, over the next several years and decades.
But no matter who quote unquote wins, it's easy to imagine a scenario in which all of us lose. Because finding a way to regulate the way our data is collected and shared isn't just about stopping bad guys from using our data against us. It's also about maintaining our freedom to make choices without fear or self-censorship. If there's one thing that keeps you up at night, a real-world scenario, what is it?
What keeps me up at night right now is looking at the breaking down of the social contract in America and seeing how the transformative forces of artificial intelligence and robotics and business and in society and in culture and, of course, in security are potentially going to exacerbate those trends. By that, I mean the algorithmic power to exploit our worst tendencies.
Peter and August say, as Americans, we've become a very brittle power, partly because of our over-reliance on high-tech systems and partly because we've prioritized innovation and ease over privacy and, well, freedom. Finding a way to thread the needle to innovate without also shooting ourselves in the foot will make all the difference.
So this is a far more profound inflection point than a lot of people, I think, appreciate. But hopefully by studying some of the technologies, by learning what they actually mean for these different aspects of our lives, we'll perhaps be able to be a little bit more optimistic.
Things That Go Boom is produced by Inkstick Media and distributed by PRX. Our show is produced by Ruth Morris, Marin Lazian, and me. Darian Shulman composes our music, and our engineer is Robin Wise. Thanks to John Barth for his editorial support. And thanks to the foundations that make our work possible: the Carnegie Corporation of New York, MacArthur Foundation, N-Square, and Plowshares Fund, as well as Inkstick supporters, including the Colomb Foundation, Prospect Hill Foundation, and the Jubitz Family Foundation. And just in case you haven't already heard, we're conducting an audience survey. We'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes to visit survey.prx.org/boom and weigh in. That's survey.prx.org/boom. Thanks so much. We'll see you in 2 weeks with our final episode of the season. You know what pirates like?
They like gold and treasure.
So what do sailors do if there are clouds in the sky? How do they get home?
They use flashlights. Well, Mom, I know a way we can get up there.
How can we get up there?
If we had rocket boosters on this, you could, like, just fly right there.
From PRX.